I had thought of looking some at the Church of India, some of the early mission efforts there that are they're quite instructive in your theology of missions. But I couldn't find that lecture. I took it out of the notebook at one point and used it for I don't know, Sunday school class or something, and then and I didn't put it back, and so I don't know where it was. But but I do notice the one thing that we have not done, and this I must say, as a caveat, this is not one of the Calvino lectures tonight. Okay, this is not one that I've done in Mexico. So technically, this is not a Calvino lecture. And you might have noticed that I don't have it listed as a Calvino lecture at the top of the of your handout. But the Church of the East, and we're looking, you know, the Asia, the Asian Church, is something that we don't hear a whole lot about. Most, you know, in most of Protestant Christendom and evangelical world, we hear about the Reformation. You know, among Presbyterians, we might hear about the Puritans or the Covenanters. We don't often hear about the church in Asia, and that's what I wanted to take a look at, just in kind of broad, sweeping strokes. Take a look at the Asian church, the Church of the East. The Church of the East, which is really distinct from both the Western, that is the Roman Church, as well as the Eastern, or what we call the Eastern, or the Byzantine, or the Greek Church, is held to have begun at Edessa, which is now a city in Turkey called Urfa, which was the capital of a small kingdom in northern Mesopotamia. In the early 2nd century, there was a church in Edessa whose bishops traced their succession to Serapion, who was bishop of Antioch from 190 to 203. It's interesting to note that the coins of Edessa from 180 to 192 have on the king's headgear the sign of the cross. The Church of the East, though we don't normally pay as much attention to it as we do to the development of the Western Church, it's a very significant work of God in the world, such that by the year 800, we find more Christians living east of Damascus than west. Where the Western Church soon was dominated by Latin translations, the Church of the East had its scriptures in Syriac. And in the Peshtta, we find a direct translation from the Hebrew, essentially from the Masoretic text, that's very ancient, dating back to at least 350 AD, though Burkitt claims it was actually a revision of an old Syriac scripture dating all the way back to the 1st century. Very ancient for existing manuscripts. One of the reasons for the separation of the Church of the East from the Roman Church was the practical matter of escaping the persecutions that would be coming on the Roman Church for political reasons, and we talked a little bit about that. But probably a more significant reason had to do with our friend Nestorius. In 484 AD, the Church of the East gathered a synod in Bethlehem in order to adopt its confession. This confession was what Rome called a Nestorian confession, and it was responding against a growing monophysite element, particularly in the Roman Church. Monophysitism was the heresy made popular by Eutyches of Alexandria, that Christ had only one nature, the divine, after his ascension, because they felt his human nature had been swallowed up and divinized like a drop of wine in the ocean. And as opposed to that, of course, the Church of the East preferred Nestorius' teaching that Christ had two natures, two kenumei, and that's the Syriac term. Nestorius was more at home in the Syriac language, which is one of the reasons he was so misunderstood when they had their debates in Greek. He was not quite, and perhaps we can look at that in more detail when we look at historical theology or history of dogma or something. But anyway, two kenume, the Syriac term, meaning two personalities, two sets of personal characteristics of each nature, which were united in one person. So you have two natures, the human and the divine, in one person. The monophysite heresy was very influential in Upper Mesopotamia, and thus the Church of the East decided at this synod to separate itself from the Western Church, not just in terms of ecclesiastical jurisdiction, but also in terms of its doctrinal confession. And so thereafter, they considered themselves a different church, the Church of the East. And from that point forward, not only in practice, but in point of fact, there were two Christian churches in the world, the Roman and Byzantine, and the Church of the East. The Roman and the Byzantine Church had their own differences in terms of Christology, of course. The Roman Church was duophysite, two natures, while the Byzantine Church had become rather thoroughly monophysite, yet they were still one church, the Western Church, the Roman Church. But the Church of the East was distinct and separate, duophysite after the Nestorian model, that is the truly Nestorian model, not the caricature that was painted by Rome, and also distinct and separate in its ecclesiastical jurisdiction and church government. In 499, there was another synod of the Church of the East that rejected the Western doctrine of the celibate clergy. Well, we find that numerous of these Nestorian Christians, these Syrian Christians, began to expand eastward and to take their knowledge with them into Persia. They became a significant influence on the Persians and the Arabs. They were renowned for their learning, for their intelligence, and particularly for their medical practice. The Nestorians were renowned as doctors. The Arabs got their first introduction to Greek literature through these Syrians and learned of modern medical practices through those Nestorian physicians at Edessa. Now, these Nestorian Christians, these Syrian Christians, who were noted for their keen minds, they had a real grasp of the importance of Christian education. Every bishop made an effort to maintain a school in conjunction with his church, and they placed a great emphasis on educating their people. We find that there were some 800 students attending one of their colleges where education was free. The students learned theology, they attended regular church services, and they lived and they ate together. By the year 424 AD, the Nestorian missionaries had moved northward and had planted churches so that Merv, Nishapur, and Herat, south of the Oxus River, in what today would be Iran and Afghanistan, all had bishops and were teaching converts how to read and how to better grow their gardens. It was the Nestorian missionaries who brought an understanding of the medieval value, or the medicinal value, of fresh fruits and vegetables, and even the use of sherbet made from fruit juices and rhubarb, and special, they spread this knowledge throughout the Orient. In the early 8th century, we find great numbers of conversions among three major tribes in the Orient, Central Asia. The Karaite, who numbered over 400,000 families converted, with the Onguts and the Uyghurs also having great numbers of conversions. The Uyghurs in particular became known as one of the most sophisticated, knowledgeable, and intelligent tribes in the Orient. As early as 636, these missionaries made their way into China, and for 150 years they had an active mission there. The influence of the Syrian Christian movement into the East thrived for years, tolerated by early Mohammedans in political power in the East. A Nestorian had at one point been Mohammed's teacher, by the way, and certain Christian communities had actually helped Mohammed in some of the early military battles against the pagan tribes. Well, such was the effect of the spread of the gospel during this time that from the 7th to the 9th centuries, that Gibbons claims the number of Christians in the East outnumbered those in the Greek and Latin churches combined at the beginning of the 9th century. Christianity in China was from an early date referred to as the Ta Chin religion, referring to their origins west of the sea, or the west of the Persian Gulf. We find an interesting monument to these early and influential missionary endeavors in what's called the Nestorian Monument. Jesuit priest came across this stone in 1625, which had been dug up by Chinese workmen a few years before. It stands 9 feet high, 3 feet wide, and it's a foot thick. At the top are carved two dragons, a Nestorian cross, on the top of your notes is that's what a Nestorian cross looks like, and a large Chinese inscription reading, "A monument commemorating the propagation of the Ta Qin luminous religion in the Middle Kingdom," or Qin'a, China. It then carries a long detailed inscription with priceless historical details and the names of some 70 missionaries given in Chinese and Syriac. It was composed by a fellow by the name of Adam, who was a Persian presbyter, and its erection took place on the seventh day of the first month of 781 AD. The stone describes the arrival of the missionaries in 635, their warm welcome by the emperor, and his instructions for them to put some of their writings into Chinese, which they did to the tune of 530 manuscripts. They were given the royal permission to stay and teach in 638, and they were given a monastery outside the city of Chuqi, about 30 miles from Chang'an, in the Gansu, what's the Gansu province in upper Han River, the capital, which today is known as Qi'an. The monastery was built specially for them by imperial funds. It was well furnished. Some of the Tang emperors sent their portraits to be displayed there, and they gave generously for the maintenance and the support of this monastery. In return, the priests promised to pray for them, as well as their ancestors, every day. And we find other evidence of this early Christian activity in the numerous tombstones adorned with the Nestorian cross, dating from the early Tang era, scattered throughout China. The Tunhuang Cave in western China had been sealed in 1036 and was opened only as early as 1900 and found to contain more than 2,000 manuscripts, many of them Christian. Also found in that cave was a remarkably preserved silkscreen painting, unmistakably of an early Oriental Christian bishop with a cross-adorned gold crown, two other crosses round his neck, holding a bishop's rod in one hand, and the other hand held in the early Nestorian symbol of the Trinity, the thumb touching the tip of the middle finger, and the other three fingers extended. Reproduction of that painting is found in on the back cover of the book By Foot to China by John M. L. Young. This particular symbol of the Trinity does not occur in Buddhist culture until quite later, as the Buddhists had to borrow liberally from the Christian tradition to boost their waning popularity. We also find a Uyghur tomb containing early 11th century coins and several Nestorian crosses excavated in Manchuria in 1927. The Uyghurs were a tribe that proved very receptive to the early missionaries and very quick to learn. Perhaps most significant is the Syriac script that is to be found scattered throughout Manchuria, as seen even today over the entrances of some ancient buildings. But not just in China. Also in Japan and Korea, there's evidence of early Christian influence, though it seems to have taken hold really with more vigor in China. In Japan, we find an inscription dating from the 7th century on the beams of an ancient temple with crosses and a script written in an alphabet that's very close to Syriac. These are now housed in the Tokyo National Museum. We have record in 797 of a returning envoy from China bringing with them a Persian called Lemitzi, a dignitary of the Church of the Luminous Religion, who was also, predictably, a physician. we find that the Empress Komyo came under the influence of his teaching, and while we don't have enough evidence to say that she was positively converted, we do find her building a hospital, an orphanage, and a leprosarium, works of mercy that typically marked the Nestorian practical Christianity, but was not at all like the Buddhism of that day. In Kyoto, the oldest building is the lecture hall of the Koryu-ji Buddhist Temple. It was rebuilt in 1165. But the original structure, built in 603, was not Buddhist, but was Christian, according to Tashima. We also find in Korea evidence of an early Christian presence, such as the cave in southwest Korea, with an opening carved in the pattern of the Christian cave churches of Syria, with carved stone plaques depicting Syrian Christian scenes. In ancient Korean literature, written in the Chinese characters, Dr. Holdcroft, author of Into All the World, points to numerous references to God in terms of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And Dr. J.S. Gale, an American scholar of ancient Korea, says unequivocally, yes, all of Asia had the gospel, but lost it. And possibly one of the most amazing chapters in the spread of Christianity in Korea is that of the Korean alphabet. I have never seen an alphabet so logically arranged or so easy to learn as the Korean. It all fits together linguistically. It makes sense. I mean, any other alphabet that you learn is kind of random, you know. But the Korean is very structured, very logical. This incredible alphabet is believed to have been created by Christian missionaries over a millennium ago, to have been revived by a Korean king some 500 years ago and then discarded, only to have been revived again by Protestant missionaries for the gospel's propagation during the past century. So says John Young. His book, by the way, I believe is still available in the tuck shop at Covenant College. I don't think you'll be able to find it very successfully online. I think I found only two copies online used at $70 a pop or something like that, some ridiculous price like that. But I think it's still available at the tuck shop if you want to get one. So what happened? If the gospel was so influential and widespread in Asia, why did it not continue in its influence as it did in the West? Well, there are a complex of contributing factors that led to the waning of Christian influence. But one above all else that I think should be most instructive to us today, we'll look at in a moment. But the beginnings of this decline, particularly in China, we find in AD 845, when the emperor enacted an act of proscription. While this act was not aimed specifically at the Christians, but really at the Buddhist monks and the nuns, whom he saw as leeches sucking the life out of the empire, the act came to affect Christians as well. Monasteries were demolished or taken over by the government. Priests and nuns were kicked out, forced to abandon their orders. Though this act only lasted 2 years, its effects were never undone. Buddhism never really recovered, which is probably the main reason Buddhism never became as powerful and dominant in China as it did in Japan. And more pertinent to our inquiry here, the Christian work suffered greatly as well. But the Christian testimony in China, while it was greatly weakened and diminished, it was not entirely obliterated. It was not this emperor's act that would undo Christianity. 3 centuries later, there was a great revival of Christianity in China under the Khans. It was during this time that entire tribes in the north were so dramatically affected as to almost entirely embrace Christianity. The Karaites, the Naimans, and the Uyghurs that we've seen before became essentially Christian tribes. They were noted for their high level of culture and intelligence, and achieved remarkable literacy using the Uyghur alphabet, which came from the Chinese missionaries' adaptation of the Syriac. The Khans always preferred to use Uyghurs as their secretaries. They were so gifted. The gospel continued to spread, but did not reach the zenith of its influence till the coming of Genghis Khan. Genghis was born in 1167. And when his father, a Mongol chieftain, died in battle, Genghis became chieftain of his small clan. Well, he made an alliance with a Christian Karaite chief, called Prester John, or Presbyter John. And together they gained a rather large power base. Well, unfortunately then, Prester John, who was by now quite old, was convinced by foolish counsel to attack the Mongols. And the Mongols won. Karaite was defeated, and Prester John was killed. So by 1205, Genghis was the sole ruler over the whole area of the Mongolian plains. The next year, he was elected emperor with the name Genghis Khan, or Emperor of All Men. Up until then, he had been called Temujin. Well, he then succeeded in conquering the Manchu Qin dynasty in the north of China, and then he could turn his attentions toward the awesome and powerful Muslim armies of the Shah of Khwarezm. Islam was then at its height and had been getting the best of the Western Crusaders, as well as what was left of the old and feeble Greek Empire in Asia. The Muslims had superior arms and technology. They even had some guns and flaming naphtha. But God, in his ironic providence, used Genghis Khan to totally overthrow the Muslim force, reducing their powerful cities to rubble heaps. Millions were put to death, and sadly, many Christians who had been living in these cities among them. When it was all over, Genghis Khan ruled from Beijing to Mesopotamia, from the Napier River to the Indus. The destruction was awesome. And in all this conquest, Genghis Khan destroyed more of the human race than any modern expert in total warfare. So says Dawson. Well, he rested for only a few years before he headed southeast to conquer the Song dynasty in South China through Kansu, the center of the kingdom of Tibet. And it was there he died in 1227. Genghis called himself the Scourge of God, and his code of laws for the Mongol life was intriguing. He said, "It is ordered to believe that there is only one God, creator of heaven and earth, who alone gives life and death, riches and poverty as pleasures him, and who has over everything absolute power." His code also noted for religious toleration, granting to persons whose lives are solely dedicated to their religious practices exemption from paying taxes. Wouldn't that be nice? The Mongol emperors relied quite a bit on Christian scribes, administrators, and physicians to help them in their government. Many of the Khans took Christians of the Uyghur or the Karaite tribes as their wives. Ironically, the next Khan, who had a Christian wife and son, became the most feared man in all of Europe, Ogatai Khan. In 1236, Ogatai moved his armies westward under the command of his two most able generals, Batu and Subutai. The armies thundered into Europe, devastating every form of resistance in their way. Kiev was destroyed. Both the Polish and German armies were destroyed near the city of Legnitz, which was also massacred. The Hungarian army of 100,000 was defeated as the two Mongolian generals joined their forces. Pest, or Budapest, fell, and in less than two short months in 1214, three of Europe's greatest armies and several lesser ones as well had been utterly destroyed. They entered Austria, wreaking havoc wherever they went, and there was no army left to stop them from taking Vienna. The whole civilization of Europe was in danger of collapse when God intervened in a most unusual way by a woman. Back in China, a mistress of the Khan poisoned Ogatai, and he died. Well, the generals then were recalled from their European invasion to take part in a council meeting to elect a new Khan. Thus, by the hand of a woman, was Europe spared. The Europeans were so alarmed that they set about to send envoys to the Khans to see if they might come to some kind of understanding. The Europeans called the Mongols Tatars, referring to them as their neighboring tribe, or Tartars, referring to them as having come from Tartarus, or hell. Today we might say hellions. One such envoy from Pope Innocent IV, a fellow named Carpini, was there to see Ogatai's son, Guyuk, elected as Khan. Guyuk, interestingly, was a Christian, as was his mother, as were many of his advisors and ministers. His camp was full of bishops, priests, and monks. It's fascinating to see part of Guyuk's message to the Pope, which he sent by Carpini. It reveals a penetrating critique of the medieval European mindset of Christendom. He says this: "The contents of your letter state that we ought to be baptized and become Christians. You wonder at so great a slaughter of men, especially of Christians, and in particular Poles, Moravians, and Hungarians, because they did not obey the word of God and the command of Genghis Khan and the Khan, but took counsel to slay our envoys. Therefore God ordered us to destroy them and gave them into our hands. For otherwise, if God had not done this, what could man do to man? But you men of the West believe that you alone are Christians and despise others. How can you know to whom God deigns to confer his grace? But we, worshiping God, have destroyed the whole earth from the east to the west in the power of God." Interesting words. Yet we find from this time that the Khans no longer attacked Europe, and later sought an alliance with the powers of Europe that we'll talk about in a moment. Well, Guyuk was unfortunately poisoned by a disagreeable sub-Khan named Batu in 1248, after which Guyuk's mother served as regent till another Khan was elected in the person of Mangu, whose mother was a Christian, and whose brother, Kublai, succeeded him in 1259. And it's Kublai Khan, who is so famous from the expeditions of Marco Polo and his 25 years experience there in the Yuan dynasty. Kublai was certainly a more peaceful ruler than his predecessors, particularly after two failed attempts to conquer Japan. The Christian influence during his time was at its height, and Marco Polo mentions many Nestorian Christians and churches that he found there. Interestingly, it was a Christian priest who was dispatched as an envoy to gain support and build an alliance of Mongol and European forces for the purpose of liberating Palestine from the Muslims. Now, this is the priest from the Church of the East coming to seek an ally with Europe. That's the attempted alliance I spoke of earlier. Christian forces in the East trying to join Christian forces of Europe to reclaim Jerusalem from Islam. The envoy, named Salma, visited Philip IV of France, Edward I of England, and Nicholas IV, the new pope, participated in worship services with them, while the European monarchs, though they liked the idea of reclaiming Jerusalem, were simply unable at the time to raise a sufficient army to help with a Palestinian undertaking. A more significant outcome, though, was had in an increased understanding between the churches of the East and the West. Edward was amazed at this Christian envoy from the East and marveled at the significance of this Church of the East. While Salma was clearly understood to be a Nestorian Christian from the Nestorian Church, who performed the liturgy in Syriac, not Latin, both Edward and the Pope received communion from him as one legitimately authorized to give it. There were no charges of the Nestorian heresy, no accusations of a heretical Christology. It had by now become apparent that what had separated the Church of the East had not in fact been an heretical Christology after all. In fact, in the summer of 1274, the Council of Lyons passed an act of union, which was recognized by both the Eastern and the Western churches. The Pope sent back with Salma his official recognition of the Eastern Patriarch Marcos, ruling under the name Maryabalaha III, as the legitimate patriarchal authority over all the Orientals. And so for this brief historical moment, kings, emperors, and sovereigns all the way from the Atlantic to the Pacific were either Christians themselves or friendly to Christianity. I say this brief historical moment because after Kublai Khan died in 1294, his Yuan dynasty lasted only until 1369, when the Ming Revolution established the Ming dynasty, which vigorously opposed Christianity and within a short decade brought a thorough suppression of Christianity in China and kicked the Christians out of Beijing and out of all positions of government. Persecution was leveled against the Christians on all fronts, and Christians were forced to either flee the country, abandon Christianity, or go underground in secret Christian societies. Then the great military leader Tamerlane rivaled the military mastery of the great Khan, both in skill and ruthlessness. Only Tamerlane did so as a Muslim. As Dr. Young summarizes his destruction, the Pax Tataris had brought open highways and 7,000 miles of peaceful interchange of commerce. The new rule of the Muslims turned fair lands into deserts, closed the door to the distant merchant and the missionary, and erected an iron curtain between the East and the West. While earlier Mohammedism had been tolerant of Christianity, Tamerlane ruthlessly harried the Christians to near extinction throughout Asia, so much so that by 1400, only small remnants of secretly hidden Christians remained in the smallest corners of Asia. Such a devastating slaughter was not to be repeated in that land until the advent of Mao Zedong's massacre of some 45 million people, including at least 200,000 Christians, in our modern history. So what was the cause of the virtual disappearance of what was at one time the most promising Christian influence in the world? Why did Christianity not emerge victorious in Asia as it did in the West? And what lesson is there in all of this for us? Well, Dr. Sakey has given his list of 10 causes for the failure, among which he names one, Nestorianism in China was a foreign religion from the beginning and remained so to the end, he says. He mentions that the Nestorian church members and leaders in China were largely foreigners, not Chinese, not native Chinese. The Nestorian document, the Nestorian monument that we mentioned lists 72 names, out of which only one might be Chinese. Two, he lists the excellence of the Chinese civilization, material and spiritual, was superior to that of London at the opening of this century. That is, if Christianity was so great and so superior as a religion to the religions of China, then why did the West have so little civilization, comparatively, to show for it? I'm not going to list all of his reasons, but he lists as number six, the loss of imperial favor and support occurred in the 9th century with the outlawing of Christian and Buddhist monasteries in 845. We mentioned that. The Christian community never really fully recovered from this setback. Eight, he lists as the monogamic principle of the Christians was unpopular with the polygamic Chinese and Mohammedans. Only one wife? He lists as number nine, there was constant badgering and sometimes violent persecution from the Mohammedans. And then number ten, and the converted tribesmen in the armies of the Mongol Khans died like flies as these mercenaries fought the wars of conquest, or were lost through the sinking of the invading fleet off Japan in a typhoon, while the eventual destruction of the civilizations from Delhi to Damascus under the ruthless Tamerlane decimated masses of Christians. His 10 reasons. Yet in all of this, I think the main and fundamental reason for the demise of Christianity in Asia was something different. While these 10 causes were certainly contributing factors, some more strongly than others, what ultimately proved the mission's undoing was something more fundamental to their mission. That is, their over-accommodation of the gospel to the surrounding culture. There was, as Dr. Young puts it, the constant effort to phrase the gospel in the philosophical terms of the court, to make it intellectually acceptable to that society, even though those terms had a strictly Buddhist or Taoist connotation, thereby, to the extent it was done, lessening the uniqueness of the gospel as the word of the holy God to sinful men. Its voice was muffled and confused when heard in the terminology of the pagan religions. Eventually, he says, as we see in the last manuscript in Chinese, the gospel itself was entirely missing. Their original translations from Syriac to Chinese in 635, accomplished in so hurried and really unskilled a manner, relied very heavily on native Chinese religious terminology that obscured rather than clarified the gospel message. Later missionaries, who had the luxury of more time and more familiarity with the language, still arrived at manuscripts which in many places are hardly distinguishable from Taoist or Buddhist treatises. Another aspect of this over-accommodation was the shifting of emphasis to accommodate the patronage of the emperor, particularly the increasing emphasis on praying for the emperor's dead ancestors. The Nestorians had rejected the doctrine of purgatory, unlike the Roman Church. Yet they spent more and more of their energy praying for ancestors, a practice that fits quite well with early Oriental religious practice. Seven times a day, they devoted their energies to praying for the dead imperial ancestors. And prayer for the dead came to comprise a major part of their effort. And while in the earliest days one might at least understand the immense pressure, there's a lack of a solid grasp of the language and so on that brought about these accommodations, yet as Dr. Young says, the tragedy was that as time went on and some of these factors changed, notably their knowledge of the language, culture, and religious concepts, they did not make a more serious attempt to disentangle themselves from the use of terminology and practices which make it increasingly difficult to distinguish between the superstitions of the pagan religions and their own rites. The missionaries' concern to make their message understandable resulted in an over-contextualization, a syncretism with pagan thought by which the uniqueness of Christ and his way was lost. The heresy of the Christians in China, says Dr. Young, was not their Christology, but their necrolatry. Idolatry, be the worship of idols. Necrolatry, the worship of the dead. It was the concept and practice of this which grew until it dominated their worship and consumed their religion. A gospel that was completely faithful to the biblical witness, a gospel that was unadulterated by Buddhist and Taoist concepts, may, it can be argued, have weathered all of those other storms that we mentioned that brought about the eventual demise of Asian Christianity. This has been a recurring problem, plaguing mission efforts of the Roman Church as well. They had a very strong tendency to go to the leaders of a particular country or district, wherever they were planning their mission, and then to kind of go native in a really big way. And while we certainly understand that evangelism does not by any means equal westernization, we're to evangelize, not Americanize, you see, and cultural differences are perfectly legitimate. And the gospel should not be cluttered up and obscured by the idiosyncrasies of our Western culture, yet we must also recognize just as strongly that the gospel can be equally obscured and cluttered by the syncretism that clothes the gospel in the language and customs of the pagan religions that are a part and parcel of that culture. So we would say that as the Syrian missionaries in China went really too far in their use of Buddhist and Taoist religious language, as well as their increasing concentration on the dead ancestors, so also the Roman missionary, Matthew Ricci, confused the gospel unnecessarily, going about as he did, dressed in the garb of a Confucius scholar. And Robert de Novoli, the Romanist missionary to India, who dressed himself in the dress of a Brahmin. As with the Nestorian missionaries in Asia, so Romanist missions also nearly always suffered from syncretism, which obscured rather than clarified the gospel. To digress for just a moment, I see this in Mexico. In the Roman Church, of course, huge in Mexico. And yet they became huge in Mexico largely by this mission strategy of syncretism. One of the most popular attractions in Mexico City, which I've seen a number of times, it's also a nice tourist trap, is the Basilica de Guadalupe, the Basilica of Guadalupe. And what it is, Guadalupe was an Aztec goddess. And the Roman Catholics found, interestingly, that this fellow, this peasant fellow, had a vision. And this vision, what was his name? Something Cortez, don't remember.
Hernando.
Hernando Cortez had a vision, thank you, of, here was the Virgin Mary. Well, Guadalupe. And the vision essentially said, hey, don't you know, I am your mother. You've been worshiping Guadalupe all this time. Really, you've been worshiping the Virgin Mary. So, great, Guadalupe will build her a church. Just understand she's really the Virgin Mary, you see. And so they've got, there's the old basilica and there's the new basilica. And they've got all of this, and all over the country, the same situation, where you have the pagan the pagan gods and goddesses, the pagan practices, kind of baptized and kind of transformed for the use of the Roman Church in propagating Romanism, a syncretism. So who are you really worshiping? Are you really worshiping the Virgin Mary, who you shouldn't worship in the first place? Or are you really worshiping the Aztec goddess Guadalupe? On the plaza of the basilica, I remember seeing a number of the, what do you call them, spiritual people, the witch doctor, the equivalent of a witch doctor, I guess. They're burning their incense, and they're and people are coming, paying them money, and they're getting these blessings, waving the incense around, you know, and driving away the evil spirits. And they're it's the old Aztec practice that's still kind of sanctioned by the Roman Church. That's okay. It's all part of, you know, all part of one big happy family of, of syncretism in which the gospel is lost. I was speaking some time ago, well, it's been many years ago now, to an Iranian friend of mine who was converted from Islam to Christianity. Actually, he was in my wedding. We had an Iranian in my wedding and an Ethiopian in my wedding. We're covering it all. Cross-cultural wedding here. And then there was me. But he...
from the hills of Kentucky.
Another foreign country.
Oh, it is indeed. He was making great strides in the Christian faith in one of our Reformed Presbyterian churches here in the States. And he's talking to me, and he says, Bill, you need to understand that some of your missionaries to the Muslim people are counteracting their own efforts. So they come in and they begin emphasizing everything that Christianity and Islam have in common. They spend all their time telling us how similar we are to Christianity. And he says, as long as I was hearing that message, I saw no need to change. After all, if we're so close to each other, why should I bother? In fact, with just a little modification, you could simply become a Muslim. It was not until one of your Christians began to emphasize the radical differences between my Islamic faith and the real truth of the gospel, and how really wrong I was, and how in need of Jesus Christ I really was, that I saw any use in leaving Islam. It was only when the depth of my need was pressed home to me that I could have any hope in the gospel. And that, he said, was the changing point in my life. When Christianity was no more of the syncretism, no more of the just you and me, we're all in this together. Rather, there is a difference between the truth of God's word and the paganism or Islam or whatever it is that your culture has taught you to believe. And so the gospel must remain clear and distinct. And in the Church of the East, that was the big problem, was that it did not remain clear and distinct. Now, we should not bury the gospel in our own cultural baggage. You know, there are those who think that evangelism is the same as Americanization. We go and we Americanize them, and then that's okay. We don't want to bury the gospel in our cultural baggage, which we have a tendency to do. But we also dare not bury the gospel in their cultural baggage, you see, so that there's an unnecessary confusion between the truth of God and their paganism from which they've come. And that was a problem in the Church of the East. I would like to bring you up to date with everything that's going on in the church in the East now, in China. Don't know a lot. Can't really know a lot because it's got to be in secret under the communist regime. It was very dark days after Mao Zedong took over in China. That was actually Dr. John Young, who wrote the book, was there when that happened. He was there watching when Mao Zedong's forces forced Chiang Kai-shek to leave mainland China, and he actually, Dr. Young saw the line of soldiers, hand over hand, bags of money from the Bank of China, taking it to Taiwan, where what Dr. Young would say was the legitimate government of China was set up. So he saw the beginning of the end there, and then of course how the church was just betrayed, and 45 million people were murdered by Mao Zedong. And so anything after that, the government tried everything it could to extinguish Christianity in China. And yet, people have tried to extinguish Christianity before, many places. Very often not entirely successful, so we find interesting things going on over there. My father-in-law works with military Christians in military service, or uniformed service, I should say, military or police service, all around the world. And in a number of his conferences, he speaks with people whose names he cannot repeat, whose identities he cannot allow to be known. And they have to be very careful as to how they communicate with these people, because they are Christians in military in communist China and in other Eastern communist regimes. So the church is is very interestingly thriving in some areas where we might not expect it. And of course, one of those is Korea. I may have told you about the Westminster Biblical Missions. I am the field chairman for Mexico, but we have Clinton Foraker is our field chairman for Hungary, and there's a little seminary in Miskolc. I taught a little thing over there once, and that seminary trains Hungarians for ministry, and they go out as missionaries in various places. And one of these Hungarian missionaries went to a little village in Romania. Well, another seminary that Westminster started was in Korea many, many years ago. That seminary is now completely self-supporting, self-sustaining, and doesn't, we don't have to do anything. It's completely their work now. We work ourselves out of a job, which as missionaries we try to do. And and thriving in Korea. Presbyterian Church is huge in Korea. And interestingly, as this seminary student from Miskolc, Hungary, goes to start his work in Romania, somebody tells me, you know, there's already a Reformed missionary in this village. A Reformed missionary? From where's he from? He's from Korea. He's from the very seminary that Westminster started in Korea. And he's made his way as a missionary to this little village in Romania and got there before the guy from Hungary. So just remarkable things going on in the church in the East, in places you might not expect to see the Lord working very powerfully by his Spirit. But that, I think, is where we're going to leave it, because that's where my voice has left it.